to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent headline news and hopefully provide some insight and analysis of practical application that you can take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And we were considering a hostile takeover of another security podcast, but once we saw their SOC 2, we decided it was too great a risk. All right, so the first headline we're going to talk about is how to plan your M&A security strategy. And this comes to us from securityweek.com. And the article goes through and presents a bare minimum plan for evaluating a merger or acquisition and recommends checking the following six areas: existing cyber environment, data management and protections, data storage compliance, existing evaluations, gaps in role responsibilities, and current risks and threats. And if there are any red flags that appear in any one of those sections, they suggest conducting extensive internal and external threat hunting, consider an MSSP or an MDR for monitoring, as well as conduct aggressive and thorough penetration testing. So we're going to run through these six areas and talk about each one a little bit more in depth. So the first one, existing cyber environment. When conducting one of these, the question is always going to be how much detail should you go into in doing this evaluation?
Yeah, and this is a question for me because I typically see these merger and acquisition deals done kind of on the policy side or with high level people, you know, directors and above. So I always wonder how much kind of in the weeds they're going to get and really like dive into the what's on the ground there versus just kind of doing a policy and paper review.
Yeah, from my experience, it really boils down to really kind of two areas. One is how common is M&A in the organization? Because if you've done this a lot, then there's a formula, if you will, on how to conduct these and what level of detail is required. And the second part is how much time there is before you have to be completed with the M&A. And sometimes that, for really large organizations or really large mergers and acquisitions, that could be a month, multi-month, or you know, year-long process, where some others will be weeks or a month or anywhere in between the year and the month.
That makes sense. I'm just thinking personally about, we discussed this in one of our last episodes, and we're going to discuss it again in a few minutes about how the network maps and the asset inventories rarely reflect reality, especially in these days. Well, I shouldn't say these days because it's always been a problem, but the big shadow IT and, you know, marketing spinning up their own services and cloud environments and all that definitely be a bear to try and track down.
Yeah, if the organization that you're merging with or acquiring even really has any of those products, because if you're merging with a really small organization, they might not really have anything other than a tiny Visio diagram that's got like five boxes on it.
You're like, yeah, this is going to be super easy. And then you find out, nope, each department runs their own IT.
And they got one box for servers, one for workstation, one for cloud. It's like, oh, this is a real simple network.
Yeah. One of the things that I've always wondered from the security operations side is how in-depth do you get when reviewing things like incident reports and alert reviews, you know, post-incident, they had something, here's the report that has describes root cause and what they did. Are those part of a merger and acquisition review?
They can be. It depends on how well those are documented and the number of those. Some organizations, you'll do an M&A with or whatever, and they'll say, well, we've had no incidents or we've had no breaches, so we don't have any reports to provide you with. And they don't have a case management system that you can take a look at and maybe get an idea for what kind of investigations they've been conducting. You just have to kind of take their word for it that, yeah, we're fine. But if you do have the opportunity to go in and do the incident reports, depending on the volume, maybe you want to consider which categories of incidents you want to review you know, the criticality of those, or look at any kind of trending for the incidents that they seem to get over and over again, as well as look at the playbooks that they were following when conducting those incidents, because that will give you an idea about their level of maturity or their capabilities at overall incident response.
Yeah, I feel like you could probably get quite a good idea for how mature they are and how they handle it based on, you know, did they actually drive to root cause? Did they follow up on everything? Or did they just, you know, oh, malware, we closed it off, we didn't do anything.
Right. And is there case management, an Excel spreadsheet, or a folder full of Word documents, or is it an actual case management database?
Yeah, you're lucky if it's a bunch of Word documents. What are they doing with IOCs? Like, how much are they going and searching for lateral movement? Just, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff you could do if you had those reports.
Yeah, I mean, if they're doing case management where you have an incident report per, you know, Word document per incident, at least take a look at that and say, you know, is this a template where they're ensuring that key factors or key points within that incident or investigation were captured and they know to capture it within the template? Or are these, you know, whichever analyst conducted the investigation wrote it out, and it's hit or miss whether there are certain details captured within it? Really, you're trying to review these not only to see what has happened in the past, but to get a sense or a feel for how well the security team at that place has been doing their job. Now, one of the other things, in addition to the incident reports that you want to take a look at, is the current vulnerabilities and their patching. And while I would say that what their current vulnerabilities are, the criticality and such, are important to understand and know, I'd say what's more important is how successful is their vulnerability management program? Did they have SLAs in place? Are they meeting their SLAs? And along with this, this will give you an idea for what legacy systems and applications they have within their environment and how many, hopefully none, end-of-life operating systems are they running, maintaining those legacy applications.
Yeah, I think that's really just the number of like remote code executions. Like, who cares how many lows they have necessarily and like the mediums, but do they have, you know, remote code executions that are still open on external assets? Do they have, you know, Windows XP boxes sitting around? That would be really interesting to me for sure.
And hopefully none of those operating systems are in the DMZ.
I would not be surprised if they were.
Well, how else are your vendors going to get to them?
Yeah. And this is where something like attack surface management or security scorecard or that external hygiene stuff, where you can kind of turn their searchlight onto the company you're merging and or acquiring, and then see if they have something. Because again, I don't know why, maybe I'm being super paranoid about this, but I would treat everything they gave you with a little bit of as like, this is the rosiest possible picture. So I don't know, maybe I'm being a little too suspicious.
No, I would say that completely makes sense. You might actually get a better view for the organization if those came from a third party. So if they had outsourced this to an MSSP or something like that, and those third parties were providing the data, you might get a better, more a representative image of what the organization looks like. Because of course, they're going to want to put their best foot forward in presenting this stuff to your organization. And also this might actually depend on what the expectation is for the employees of the acquired company or the merged company. Because if they're going to come over with that organization and become employees of the new parent company, they're going to be have mixed emotions, I think, about doing that.
All right. The other thing that always comes up kind of is cloud service, whether they have cloud accounts, whether they're using, you know, software as a service, things like that. I don't know if that's how well is that incorporated into merger and acquisition discussions.
Yeah, if they have a CASB, that's going to give you a better idea for that kind of thing. And some, and depending on what the organization is you're merging with, it could be that they are relying mostly on like PaaS and SaaS solutions, which would actually make the merger or the acquisition relatively simplistic.
Yeah, you can just roll them onto your own systems and, you know, retire the contracts as they expire.
Right. And I'd say something else for the environment that you should really take a pretty close look at is how they're doing account management. And this is what came back and ended up being what bit Colonial Pipeline, is that they had someone leave the organization and they left that account active, and their VPN was leveraged in order to get into Colonial Pipeline. So take a look at what their account management looks like. Are they, do they have a lot of accounts in there that have, that those employees have been off-boarded or are no longer with the organization, yet those accounts remain active? So take a look at their process for account management. If you can, you know, take a look at the actual accounts which are in there. It may be pretty difficult to do that kind of review though, in order to see how many accounts are active for employees who are no longer with the organization though.
Yeah, again, it's kind of the same thing as looking at the incident reports. You're looking for evidence of whether they're actually keeping up the stuff or if they're just showing you the best.
You're looking for, you know, trending policy, you know, not specific instances, but what they've been doing or what their habits are. You know, are they properly running the organization or running their security program? So the next item is data management and protections.
So yeah, that one definitely seemed to me like a policy review, although ideally you would then go and look at how they're actually handling the sensitive data in practice.
Yeah, one of the things to consider that is, do they understand what their sensitive data is? Is it centrally located or is it all over the place? And what do they have a data management policy? That is to say that we're only collecting the data we need and we're only holding it for as long as we need it.
So I think the proof is in the pudding as to what they're actually doing with it. But again, that's somewhere you have to trust them. So I think data storage compliance is pretty much the same as that, right? Very similar.
Yeah, the only real thing to add there is, are they doing encryption? And if they're doing encryption, how are they managing their keys?
Yeah, they're in ROT 13. It's totally secure. Work for Caesar, works for us. So existing evaluations is one that interests me as well. This is the audits, assessments, vulnerability scans. We talked about a little bit before, the penetration tests. Again, I have fears that these evaluations would be cherry-picked. They wouldn't give you the penetration test that said, we were able to get in and rampage wildly.
Well, I think in addition to looking at the penetration tests, again, you want to look at that trending. So if they got a penetration 2 years ago and they got a penetration test a year ago, what were the differences between them? Did they actually action the penetration test from 2 years ago and make corrections so that the penetration test from a year ago isn't just a photocopy of the previous one?
Yeah, if you do the pen test puppy mills.
Where they just come in and run Nessus and print the report out for you. That's even better.
And if you're lucky, they may hit you a couple times with Metasploit just to kind of see maybe a brute force attack or two.
Yeah, whatever comes with Kali Linux.
Yeah, this would actually be a real interesting place to look at the audit results too, to kind of look at how audit is doing things. Are they just rubber stamping stuff and, you know, every year they get an A+, or is audit really involved with digging in and figuring out whether you're doing things right or wrong and how to improve it and the relationship between audit and IT?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, if they have internal audit, third-party audit will probably more likely be something you'd prefer to look at versus internal audit. But my experience with audit has not been great. I find a lot of auditors are just looking for something to catch you on versus looking at a criteria or a framework and judging you against that criteria and framework or how well you're meeting it, or looking at your policies and say, this is what your policy says, but you're not doing that here, that's a fine, versus, oh, this box over here has an insecure login or you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I think the concept of internal audit, I think, is really good. I think I've never really seen a good implementation of it. Because auditors are really the ones that can take a look at what you're doing from a third kind of outside of, you know, your team, looking at you from the outside saying, hey, you're doing this right, you're doing this wrong. You guys should really shift over here because this is what your policy says, or this is what framework you said you're going to follow or you're maturing towards, and you're not doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the problem is most auditors are valued, or their you know, goals are to find bad things rather than to fix bad things.
Well, it's the same thing. Why I have mixed feelings about the red team as well is, are they actually doing stuff to improve versus being able to say, gotcha.
Yeah. Roaming around like a bunch of vandals.
Right.
Gaps in role responsibilities. I think there was interesting to look at, you know, if you don't have specific functions, then that's definitely somewhere to take a look. For example, I'm trying to become a security architect. So I was looking at job postings for security architects to look at what skills I should be looking to develop. And I saw a job posting where it asked for the security architect to also be a malware reverse engineer. That was very interesting to me. And that makes me think that they have a very small team there, given that they had, and that also had like incident response responsibilities, which I can understand in a small team, especially where the architect would get involved in the incident response. But the malware reverse engineering thing was very interesting.
Yeah, something to consider as well is really small organizations may not have any designated security people at all. You have an IT guy that's wearing two hats that does this and that.
I don't know, there's too much more to say there other than if they don't have anybody at the C level or the senior level who's responsible for security. Like nobody at, depending on the size of the company, nobody at the director level above or above that's responsible for security, they probably have not been prioritizing it at all. So I know just from history, like even small banks have somebody who's nominally a CISO and is, you know, responsible for that type of, you know, the risk activities and the vulnerability management maybe, and at least representing security's interests to the rest of the company. And if they don't have anybody that's dedicated to that, then they're probably popped.
Well, they have to due to regulations. This particular one eludes me up top of my head. It might be Sarbanes-Oxley requires the CISO.
Again, I'm not saying they technically have to have a CISO, but they should have somebody that has that responsibility of at least looking for it. And again, it may be a dual hat, but if they don't have anybody that has that title or that responsibility at all, that just seems like a red flag to me.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying financial institutions have a regulatory requirement.
Gotcha.
All right. And the last item was the current risks and threats. So what's your cyber hygiene and what level of vulnerabilities should you see in particular as red flags?
And again, I think we talked about that a little bit before, but I think criticals and things like remote code execution, and even more telling is if you see stuff with a name, like if you see that they still have Bluekeep, or you see that they still have, you know, like anything from like 2016, 2011, it's got a name, it had a website, it had a slogan, it had a jingle, and they've still got it on their systems, especially the external facing systems. Like Bluekeep, that's a remote code execution for RDP. If that is open on an external facing system and in the year 2021, it's almost guaranteed that they're compromised.
I think this might be going back to something we mentioned earlier about the security scorecard, is what does the organization look like from the outside? Now, if they have one of these critical vulnerabilities that's externally facing, you're almost certain that there's going to be some level of compromise.
Yeah, they may not have gotten far. Like it may have been a script kiddie, but it also may not have been. So, and then the other,
if there's a remote code execution vulnerability on an externally facing system, and that vulnerability is more than a 0-day or, you know, recent or new, I'd be very nervous.
Yeah, and this is where that cyber hygiene, the security scorecard, the attack surface management, they do allow you to, you know, scan third parties. Or even if they don't, you know, secure that as part of the merger and acquisition and hit them with Nessus or any of the other vulnerability scanners, and do some of your own research. Find out what other ASNs they may, or I'm sorry, whatever IP blocks they may own. Do some reverse lookups on their domain name, you know, check it out. That's where the attack surface management comes in really handy, because most of us have built-in methods of kind of spidering across a domain and pulling out all the stuff you've got going, for sure. But this goes back to what we talked about originally. Don't trust but verify, or don't trust, I don't know how you want to frame it, but don't trust what they give you and validate their findings yourself.
Okay, there's just a point I was trying to remember. But something to consider if your organization is conducting M&As with relative frequency, you might want to consider getting or contracting with like a security scorecard or an attack surface management company to help you do these assessments, rather than entirely relying on your security team to do all that work.
Yeah, I can imagine that if you haven't built it into your workflow and your prioritization and your, you know, how visible is all your work, that could really put a damper on the rest of what's going on. People are being pulled off of other projects in order to focus on this merger and acquisition stuff.
All right, so if you're doing these evaluations and you start seeing red flags, you know, what are some of the things you should start to consider, or something you should work on when these things pop up? And one of the first questions you should consider when you've identified the red flag is, where's the contract at the moment you've identified this? If the contract's already signed, there's not much you can do about it other than figure out how you're going to fix the problem or address it. So if the contract's signed, something you might want to talk to the legal team about is, if you acquired an organization that's been breached or has potentially been breached, and they've let customer data or something that's regulated out of the organization, what's your legal liability now? For what you've just acquired.
You just acquired yourself a nice big lawsuit. On the other hand, other than the liability side, a lot of the time when you're trying to purchase a company, you're purchasing them specifically for something, right? Like you're purchasing them for maybe their customers, you're purchasing them for the physical equipment they have. That's probably not the most common reason. Or you're purchasing them for the intellectual property that they own. And if they've been compromised and that intellectual property has been stolen, and that's the reason you're purchasing them, it may be cheaper just to buy it on the black market. No, I'm just kidding. But the main reason for purchasing the company may be gone at that point in time.
Well, and I wouldn't say it'd be gone necessarily, but it's certainly reduced in value.
That's actually interesting. I don't think we've seen that, have we? Where a company in the process of a merger and acquisition, like I know Yahoo, they were being looked at for a merger or an acquisition by Microsoft or somebody for a big number. And then after their breach, weren't they obtained for a much smaller number?
It wasn't a much smaller number, but the purchaser did get a discount. I'm trying to remember who bought them. What, man, this is.
There we go. Verizon, after data breaches, Verizon knocks $350 million off Yahoo sale. So the breach was worth $350 million to them.
Yeah, I think that was a $1 billion sale, right?
It was a $4.8 billion sale.
4.8.
Yeah, $350 million hit. That's really interesting. It's kind of fascinating to see that a number actually put on how much that data breach was worth to them. It was a 14% discount.
Wow.
Yeah, it's on sale.
That is not insignificant.
No, it's really not.
I would turn down $350
million. They just wanted to give it to you.
They just wanted to give it to me. Turn it down.
Yeah. So other thoughts on if there are red flags that maybe there's been a compromise or a breach, would the company allow you to hunt internally or place any of your detection technologies internally? Unfortunately, the chances of you doing a merger and acquisition at the exact same time as they're being compromised is probably slim. So you probably wouldn't be able to catch the attackers kind of in the process, but especially if they let you do forensics or incident response with them, or hire a third party, maybe engage Mandiant to come in and do it, but then they have to share the results with you. That may be an option. So finally, it'd be interesting, and I know this is probably not going to happen, but I'd be interested in doing a merger and acquisition pen test where you run it kind of like a purple team, where you go in and you sit with their blue team, and like you also, you know, interface with the red team you've hired and kind of watch how they respond. This is kind of what I was talking about before with the incident reports. We're trying to see how they actually respond versus their really, really pretty and also very nice policy papers.
Right. Imagine if you could drop some attack sim boxes on the network.
Yeah.
That would be a interesting experiment to run.
Yeah, and a couple of their subnets, and then, you know, we ran this, this, and this. What alerts did you get?
But of course, something that security needs to keep in mind as well is that the merger and acquisition, as you mentioned a minute ago, is not taking place all around their security. So just because their security may be terrible may have virtually no bearing on the actual merger.
Yeah, especially if the purpose of the merger is to, you know, like for example, McDonald's or some other retail chain, they might want to acquire a company to get their space. They don't really care about their intellectual property. They care about the stores that they have, or, you know, the customer base or things like that, where it may not matter if they're compromised or not, you know, unless it brings a lawsuit with it or, you know, some legal liability issues.
Right.
All right, let's move on. Why does this matter? Well, obviously, connecting a merger and acquisition directly to your network, if they're compromised, brings the bad guys right in there.
Just ask Marriott. You know, in 2018, Marriott announced that it had been compromised, and this was due to its acquisition of the Starwood Hotel chain, which apparently had been compromised in 2014, but Marriott acquired them in 2016, and then in 2018 is when they found the breach.
That's forever.
So that's a long time for that to be identified. But that 2 years between the breach, the original breach, and the acquisition, those attackers didn't simply breach in 2014 and move on as if it were done.
Hang out.
They actually maintained that and were able to use that later to move into the Marriott.
It's like a bonus for them. They did all the work and then they just sat back. And
yeah, it's a good thing they didn't bother putting any passwords on their back door. Otherwise, maybe they wouldn't have been able to get back in.
I might have forgotten them. But dang it, what did I try? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, thanks, man. Thanks.
Oh, man. Now I got to change the combination of my luggage.
What kind of idiot has that as a password? All right. So what should we do about it? Well, I guess if your org is planning a merger and acquisition, you need to make sure that security is in on that and on the ground floor. Not kind of a after the thought. I know this has been something I've heard of myself in the past, where security is kind of brought in for a rubber stamp after the merger and acquisition has been ongoing for quite a while. And that is a recipe for failure, because security is going to feel the pressure to just hit that and say, yes, go forward. Because if they throw a wrench in it at that late point, they're going to get blamed.
And this is someplace where you can be proactive. And before there's any kind of M&A, even talked about in your organization, have a conversation with your legal team and talk to them about ensuring that security is part of any M&A work that's being proposed or considered when that time happens in the future. You know, build those relationships, build those bridges ahead of time.
One other thing to do maybe to be consider treating the previous network as a hostile network and keep them at arm's reach. Don't even connect them to your network. Or if you do, do it through a secured firewall that's heavily monitored. Treat it as hostile. I mean, you should be doing that with all of your internal segments anyways, treat each of them individually as hostile and keeping them all separated. But with that external company, once you start replacing their systems with your own, then you move them more onto a more trusted network. So for example, when you bring them in, you know, everybody's probably going to be using their old laptops. As you roll out new laptops and maybe you move the voice over IP system to your own system, put those onto separate subnets, treat those as more trusted subnets or hostile, depending on how your company does it, and keep all the old stuff walled off and as isolated as reasonable.
Yeah, and consider what logical pieces of information or, you know, electronic media that the a company being acquired, you absolutely must have. You know, are there particular network segments, systems, databases, or applications that are actually critical for that you want from that organization? For instance, if you are in a financial institution and you're acquiring another financial institution, their banking application is an absolute must have and a huge part of that M&A and actually onboarding that organization to the new parent organization.
No, you're right. This goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago with what's the intellectual property or what's the property you're trying to obtain through here. Because if you're trying to obtain, you know, the stores or whatever, you can burn it all down. You might not care about anything other than, you know, the customer list and the physical locations.
Right. It almost might be like onboarding a bunch of new employees all in a bulk hire or something like that, where you need to issue new laptops and new accounts and all that kind of thing. And, you know, if you are only interested in like the databases, then, you know, doing a backup and restore those databases into your organization versus bringing those database systems in might be a much safer bet versus just unplugging those boxes and plugging them into your network. So there's a lot of moving parts in an M&A, and the sooner the security can be involved, the earlier you can detect if there are problems and address those before it becomes really serious, like the Marriott Starwood scenario.
Yeah, I'm just, I keep going back to the idea of like going back to the board. You know, it's 1 week before you're supposed to acquire and everything's signed and everything's supposed to be going, and have to be the one to raise your hand and say, I don't think this is a good idea. That's not a good place to be for sure. Versus no. if you can say that, you know, 2 weeks in before you've spent months doing it, before you spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of people hours, you know, reviewing stuff.
And one thing I would say is if you're going to raise your hand, make sure you have your documentation ready, you know, that you're going to be able to show or prove risk or a compromise or something along those lines. Because when you're talking about interrupting a business transaction like this, you have to consider what's the trade-off here. You know, how much is it going to cost to delay that merger or accept the risk of whatever it is that you found during your assessment? All right, so the next article is called Mission Critical, What Really Matters in a Cybersecurity Incident. And this comes to us from Dark Reading. So the summary of this article is the author is a consultant lawyer who comes in and works with organizations that are responding to an incident. And they have three things that they've seen consistently with incidents that they've been called in to consult on. First one is the incident response plan is rarely consulted during an incident. The second is logging is never done where you need it to be done at. And third, network maps and asset inventories are extremely important, but rarely actually up to date.
All right, so let's talk about the IR plan. This one I found The thing she said that she thought was the most critical here was making sure that you know who's in charge, and you make sure that everybody knows who is in charge. That when there's an incident, everybody knows who to call. And that's, I agree, that's important. And I feel like that's something that is frequently not followed from the IR plan. Most IR plans that I've seen usually call out an incident commander who is supposed to take charge kind of over everybody and redirect them. And a lot of times I feel like I see C-levels and VPs step in and kind of step over the incident commander and run them over sometimes. I don't know if that's something you've seen.
Well, when an incident happens, it's exciting and everybody wants to be involved in it.
Yeah, so, and I get like people that are C-levels and VPs are, I mean, the reason that they are in charge is because, you know, when stuff happens or, you know, when projects are done, they step up and they take charge. That's part of their, you know, method of getting where they are. But it's just been interesting to me that they rarely follow IR plans in that regard. And it makes me wonder sometimes how realistic the IR plans are. What I've definitely seen in the past, and I think is more appropriate, is dividing that role up into two. And we've talked about this before, having somebody who's kind of the technical incident commander and keeps the technical investigation going. And then there's somebody who's more of the corrals and reins in the C-levels and VPs and keeps them from, you know, interfering with the investigation too much. I've definitely sometimes seen that called out, but not all the time.
Right. And that could also be a reflection on how well the C-levels trust whoever's been designated as the incident commander.
Yeah, because it's usually like a SOC manager or something or sometimes a director or a senior manager, but it's usually not somebody extremely senior.
Right, it's usually mid-level.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because yeah, and the mid-level in the middle of an incident is not going to step in and shut down the C-level. So that's a career-limiting move.
Although I was at one organization that in their IR plan did call out the CIO as the incident commander.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, honestly. Because if it's that makes sense if it's a really big incident. That does not make sense for a lot of the kind of mid-level incidents. So I think a senior manager or a director, or depending on how your organization is set up, if you have like a junior VP, I guess you probably don't call any VPs junior. But I think like an upper mid-level is probably the appropriate one here.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I personally don't think putting an executive as the incident commander is a wise decision.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because even though that incident's going on, that is not the only thing that's going on in the organization.
No, you're right. Yeah,
business I spoke too quick. Still needs to get done.
Yeah, I'm probably going to delete out the part where I said the CISO, so that way I won't sound stupid.
Well, you have to delete out everything I say if we're going down that route.
No, yeah, you're right. It shouldn't be somebody that's mid-level and it shouldn't be a CISO, but someone of the director level seems appropriate because they're big enough that...
Need someone with enough clout.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know if power is the right word to use exactly.
No, but senior enough that they'll listen.
Authority.
Yeah.
Someone with the proper level of authority to get things done and yet not so high up that them now switching their dedication from what they do day to day to an incident is going to impact the business function.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you mentioned here in our notes, definitely making sure that if the C-levels and VPs like to be very hands-on and they want to get involved, you need to make sure they participate in tabletops and other IR exercises.
Right. If they're going to be the incident commander, they need to practice doing that. Like anything else, you have to build that muscle memory for things to be done correctly when something stressful like this happens. So the military likes to say train as you fight. So if the CIO is going to be the designated incident commander, you need to ensure that they participate in your tabletop exercises. If you have your CIO as your incident commander and you're doing monthly or quarterly tabletops and they are never participating, I think that's a real recipe for disaster.
Now that makes sense because everybody else will be following one playbook and then the C-level will step in and throw a wrench in everything.
Well, it's not necessarily that they throw a wrench in everything, but they are going almost entirely by gut instinct. They aren't going by what the plan was or, you know, what you have tested before. So inevitably you're going to end up with gaps or things missed within there, unless the CIO is the incident commander and his deputy has been participating in these exercises, or someone else further down the chain, but participating in the exercise, and they're able to pull them to the side and say, I know you said we should do this, but our plan is this, and we've tested this, and we planned for this.
So the second point she brings up with is whether is a consulting the IR plan during an incident. And my first question there is, does the IR plan actually have anything worth consulting during an incident? Most of the IR plans I've seen in the past have been fairly high level, and they usually are more on the prep side, like talking about who the roles and responsibilities belong to, what kind of preparation stuff. And if they do have things that should be done during an incident, those things should be procedures, not necessarily strictly in the incident response plan, right?
For the most part, one thing I would say that is typically in the IR plan that you're not going to see in procedures is the communications plan and the escalation paths. So that part needs to at least be pulled out and referenced. And usually the benefit of, well, not necessarily the benefit, but the fact that the IR plan isn't generally followed during an incident, but the parts in there that are necessary to be done, like the escalation and the communication plan, are something that are done right up front. So it's not something you have to remember after you've been involved in an incident for days or hours, or it's something that, you know, you consult the IR plan for that communication stuff right away. And then, you know, you can set that IR plan to the side and pick up your playbooks and your procedures.
And the communications plan can be built into the ticketing system too, or depending on how you report incidents, that could be automated to some extent.
Right. If you have a really good case management system, you can have those communications plans built into that system, which case you don't have to worry about actually consulting the IR plan because it's.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a great idea. You put in the notes here as well, talking about the automation and making sure the ticketing system and the case management system can make sure those procedures are followed. Because again, when you're in the heat of an incident, the last thing you want to do is try to open up a run book or try to open up a IR plan. You need as much of that automated and in your face as much as possible.
Right. And if you're doing regular trainings, the natural instinct of those people involved should, or previously been reinforced. So what they want to do is already in the procedures already, so to speak.
All right. The final thing I wanted to pull out of here is there's an interesting comment that I'm going to read verbatim from the article. Lawyers are in the room to take command and guide the organization through the murky pre-liability space. If anyone other than the in-house or outside counsel leads the incident response, the entirety of the investigation could be exposed. I have never worked anywhere or even read anywhere that lawyers are in charge of incident response. Did I miss something in the last couple of years?
Now, I think what you're missing from that quote is who wrote the article. For sure, that was a lawyer.
Shit is a lawyer.
So, surprise, surprise, the lawyer thinks it's extremely important for the legal team to be intimately involved in that.
Well, I don't disagree that the legal team should be intimately involved. Like, as soon as you find, you know, you're conducting your IR, you're, you know, looking through your malicious, your malware investigation, you're looking through your logs, and then you find that they touched a system that has, you know, sensitive data or anything regulated, yes, you absolutely should get your legal team involved, 100%. I would just be really surprised if the lawyer came in and was like, all right, I'm now in charge of this investigation. So she did mention she's external counsel too. She's usually brought in by companies. She didn't mention how big the companies were, but I could see where having a technically proficient external lawyer would be very useful to smaller companies that can't afford to bring in like a whole team or someone like Mandiant.
Yeah, she must be working with larger organizations because I've never actually seen a company bring in a lawyer as a consultant for IR.
Oh, I have. That's something I've actually seen. So they retain an external counsel that specializes in this, but then all the times that I've worked with them, they've never taken control in the investigation. They're there to kind of assist, and they do whenever the legal questions come up. So they do lead part of the investigation. They lead kind of the disclosure parts and the, you know, any of the reporting stuff once you get to the reporting side, but they don't lead the technical side and they don't lead the company side. Like, they're not telling the company what to do.
Yeah, maybe what should be our part of the legal team's involvement should be building that framework in the IR plan right up front.
Yeah, that does seem like a good idea. Kind of figuring out, you know, when it does, you know, if it's GDPR relevant, like, who is in charge? Does it remain under the incident commander? Does the legal team take charge? Or who's responsible for what, for sure? So I know a big part of this is the attorney-client privilege. And I've seen mixed messages on that. I've definitely seen some people that have thought that as long as an attorney is on, like CC'd on the email, attorney-client privilege is invoked. But I've also read in more than a few articles that that's not actually attorney-client privilege.
Well, if you have a legal team on staff or general counsel, this is certainly a question you should bring up and talk to them about before an incident happens.
You're not just going to listen to some random guy on the internet talk about it?
You didn't even stay at a Holiday Inn Express.
Oh, man. So you know what? On. I don't stay at Holiday Inn, so you're right. All right. The third part is my favorite part because I love logs. She mentioned that the logs are never there when you need them. And I actually think this is kind of part of why they got breached. I think the reason that the logs you need are never there is because that's where the bad guys find those holes. Because if you've got all the logs in a particular subnet or a particular area of your network, you probably caught the bad guys earlier than the parts of the network that aren't being monitored. If you're not monitoring the network and the bad guys get in there, they can just run rampant until you've got a full-blown incident on your hands.
Well, just because their events are logged doesn't necessarily mean that you've got an alert triggered on those events, though.
No, I get that. But I'm just saying that if you're doing your due diligence in that section of the network and you've got, you know, IDS there, you've got your firewall there, you've got a host-based monitoring system, like, you're more likely to have actually caught them versus the part of the network that, you know, maybe the merger and acquisition, or it may be, you know, the development network or the, you know, manufacturing floor network that they don't let IT touch.
Well, I think, you know, what she's trying to point out in the logging here is that once the horse is out of the barn, can you track that horse? You know, do you have logging to at least be able to go back and track those attackers through your network?
Yeah. Yeah. And she mentioned as well that companies frequently choose to skimp out on the log collection and the log aggregators because they're trying to save money. And budget's always an issue, especially with certain modern SIMs that shall remain unnamed that are charging by the gigabit of ingest
per day.
per day, which nobody knows what I'm talking about. It's a mystery. So that's definitely a struggle because you're looking at that and you're like, all right, which log events are going to be important to me? Which log events can I afford to ingest? Can I afford to go begging for more gigs so that I can bring in, you know, the packet capture data? And there's a way to avoid that. You can, you know, maybe the data that's important for the detections goes into the SIM and then you set up an S3 bucket or you set up an ELK stack or something somewhere else and then feed the other logs into there. That would certainly be cheaper than feeding it all into the SIM.
All right, kind of have like a tiering of logs.
Yeah. Yeah. The stuff that maybe you care about. I mean, you should leave some level of logs on there locally as well, but that's almost always one of the things the attackers are going to try and clear. So that can't be relied on. But yeah, you've got logs that you can use in detections, those go to the SIM, and then you've got logs that are useful for troubleshooting and for tracking adversaries, and those remain local and get sent off to kind of a second tier storage to be pulled in if they're needed.
Right, and S3, depending on what solution you're choosing or what, I can't remember exactly what they call it when S3, but they've got like Glacier and Standard and all of that. Depending on that level, those costs can be pretty inexpensive if your expectation is to put them there just in case versus actively reviewing those logs on a regular basis.
Yep. And our final point was on the network maps and asset inventories. And I have to agree, those never seem like they're up to date. And even when they are up to date, frequently they're not exceptionally useful. It's sometimes difficult to just look at them and kind of tell, just because modern networks are so complex. It's sometimes difficult to just tell like where an attacker could have gone from there. But I also feel like this is related to how attackers think in graphs and defenders think in lists, where the attackers are looking for, you know, where can I reach from this box? And the defenders are, you know, going through their list and their procedure, trying to knock them out of that box and not necessarily thinking about where they went laterally.
And this is where having like an active network mapping tool, like a FireMon, which used to be Lumetta IP Sonar, actually mapping your network on a semi-regular basis. We talked about this last week or the week before.
Yeah, we're probably going to talk about it many times.
How attackers are going through the network and they're discovering the network as they go. So their map of the network is going to be much more accurate than your map, which you got from the network team that they updated once every quarter or annually.
If that, yeah. All right. Well, why does this matter? Well, you should consider this your annual reminder. Well, hopefully more often than annual, to update your network maps, your asset inventories, your logging, and your IR plan. Get those updated.
So what you can do about this is at least ensure that your logs have the ability for you to track lateral movement.
Yeah, that's usually where things fall apart, especially if you've got a modern EDR tool. You can usually do pretty good at figuring out exactly what they did on the system, but especially if they went lateral within the subnet, like it can be real hard to figure out where they went.
Yeah, that's pretty much almost impossible without that EDR. And of course, conduct regular exercises and practice what your plan is. Because if the IR plan, I don't want to necessarily say it goes out the window when an actual incident happens, you want to ensure that you build it in the habits to follow that plan, even though you don't have it right in front of your face.
All right. We'll go ahead and put in the show notes some cheat sheets from Malware Archaeology on suggested logging, the NIST 800-61 guide for incident response if you need to update your IR plan, and there'll also be some information on S3 logs, so you can upload those logs there. So the final article we're going over today is something fun that I picked out since my background is in IR. Researchers uncover process ghosting, a new malware evasion technique. It is a new way for attackers to mess with on-disk forensics. In the article, they mentioned three recent ways, semi-recent ways to mess with forensics. Two of them are from the last year, one of them is from 2017, which I had somehow missed. And I haven't seen any of these in person, although one of them has me thinking that I saw it at some point, because it sounds pretty similar to what I've seen at one point in time. So the first one is process doppelganging. It is similar to process Halloween, but the way that process Halloween works is you suspend a process, which writes it to disk, you overwrite the suspended process, and then you restart it, and that runs whatever malicious that you wrote into it. In this case, you are starting with a benign file, you're overwriting it with a malicious file, you are creating a memory section from the malicious file, and then use NTFS transactions to roll back the executable to the non-malicious version. When you create the process with the memory section, and it's detected as malicious, and you go and you look at the process on the disk, the process on the disk is benign, because that's usually what happens, right? You get a malware detection or an EDR detection for machine learning. And the first thing you do is you go and you pull the executable off and you run the executable through VirusTotal and you stick it in AnyRun or whatever your sandbox tool you're using. And in this case, all those would come back benign because you're running the benign executable and it's actually not. So again, similar to process Halloween. They showed at the time in 2017, this dodged all the AV and EDR vendors. I'm sure since it's 4 years old, hopefully they all detect it. Second one has the best name ever. It is called process herpaderping, where there's apparently a gap between when the process is created And when the operating system locks it so that it can't be modified. So you can run it so that it's malicious when you run it and that loads it into memory and runs it. And then you can overwrite it with something benign. So again, this is the same thing. You get a detection for something running and you go and you look at the file on disk and the file on disk is completely benign. And finally, process ghosting. This one is where they found a gap that allows you to create a file, and I'm quoting this from the article from someone named Gabrielle Landau, where you can create a file, mark it for deletion, map it to an image section, close the file handle to complete the deletion, and then create the process for the now fileless section. So when you go and you look for that process running from the disk, the process is gone. Definitely really interesting. Definitely messing with your on-disk forensics. So I see you added a note here, David. In a proof of concept demo, the researchers detailed a scenario where Windows Defender attempts to open the malicious payload executable scanner, but fails it because it's in a delete pending state. So yeah, so it looks like Windows Defender tries to scan, but fails. So that's that may be something you can look at.
Yeah, so I was thinking if that actually generates any kind of alert or log, then that might be an opportunity for you to bring that to the attention of the team and indicate that you need to grab memory versus worry about the file on the disk.
Yeah, I guess it would have to depend on how often that happens. I don't know if that generates a log, and I don't know how often it happens, but I suppose I could go back and take a look at that. It might be interesting for sure. So in terms of discussion, this is just malware attackers are always kind of working ahead. Process hollowing was the big thing a couple of years ago, and then most of the EDR tools, Navy tools detected it. So now they're kind of on to the next. And the important thing to note here is that people have been doing memory forensics for years, but memory forensics in many places is kind of below the poverty line or above the poverty line. I guess it depending on which way you're looking at it. Where most places are referring are still relying on disk forensics. They're relying on the executables that they're pulling via things like Carbon Black, the remote capabilities there, real time response in Falcon, or doing dead disk forensics. And I think that still works fine for a lot of commodity malware, and that works fine for a lot of the generic stuff that's out there. But you really need to be moving to memory forensics. You need to be using the capabilities to pull memory images, and then you can dump all of the running processes to disk and then run those executables through VirusTotal and other processes. And that's something that I'm remembering from SANS. They flag that as once the processes are running in memory, they're unarmored. Whatever type of disguising or armoring that the attacker did for the process that was written to disk, once it's in memory, all that's gone. It's a lot easier to detect malware running in memory. So that's one thing you should do. The other thing you should look at is Sysmon now detects process herpaderping and process hollowing attacks as event ID 25. And what it looks for there is it looks for when the mapped image of a process does not match the on-disk image file. So, and there's also no persistence there, at least not in the file. Whether a reboot wipes it or not is going to depend on if it managed to squirrel a copy away somewhere, maybe in an encrypted form, or if it's, you know, running out of a registry key or something like that.
Yeah, one thing I did not see in this article or any of the articles which had actually were referenced from there was, does this mean that there is no persistence? So a bounce would completely wipe this stuff and it would not recreate. So
it might recreate. For example, you could stick a script in a registry key or several other places, the run folder, start folder, where it just re-downloads the executable from a website and then reruns the executable. But you're right in that the malicious file that is running in memory is no longer on the disk.
Right. And actually, I was kind of getting to that point saying that even if your memory forensics is not great, there is still something on the disk in order to maintain persistence. And maybe that is something where you can focus some of your detections at.
Yeah, there's always something, there's always some method for persistence that has to be written to disk somewhere.
Yeah, actually, I think I'm trying to remember back to specific instances, but none are coming to mind right now. But there are instances of attackers not worrying about persistence, though. They're going to live with what they get, because their concern is more about getting caught versus having to reinfect or recompromise.
Yeah, especially if it's a server or something, for sure. That it's hardly ever restarted. And depending on what you're doing, if you're just, you know, crypto mining or something, then maybe you don't care.
Right. I'm trying to think about a piece of malware, which is not coming to the top of mind right now, that looks at system uptime as a determining factor about how it functions. You know, looking at a system saying, oh, this system has been up for 365 days, and then making a decision about whether to go for persistence or not based on that metric.
That makes sense.
I don't know if there's one out there, but I think it's a missed opportunity.
If there's not. Yeah. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter. Subscribe, like, and favorite, and all that junk on your favorite podcast app.